a glide in Turkish. It's yamashak ke is the technical term. The Evrak Hans, who put together the first significant confederacy of Turks on the steppes. They would be centered again on those eastern steppes, particularly on the Mongolian grasslands. Now, there are several features or several advantages that the Turks had acquired by the opening of the early Middle Ages. One of these is superior saddles, and with superior saddles, stirrups. We believe as early as 300 AD, nomadic peoples had devised what is often called the leather loop stirrup. It's essentially a toe hold attached to a rather high back saddle that would give you more support in riding. It would assist the archer in steering his horse and using both hands for his weapon. Well, these leather straps gave way to metal stirrups. And metal stirrups are attested certainly from the 4th and 5th centuries AD on. They are very, very quickly adopted by the Chinese. And when we talk about the clash between the Chinese and Turkish armies in the Sui and Tang dynasty, the Chinese are armed just as well as their Turkish opponents with better leather saddles and that metal stirrup. There also were certain improvements in the composite bow. And above all, the Turks turn out to be extremely skilled metallurgists. They perfect the forging of iron and steel. In fact, the name Turk, which comes to become a general name for people speaking all of these related languages, that's a term that was originally applied only to those speakers of Turkish living in the Altai Mountains, who are really vassals of the Evrak Hans. And they got their claim to fame because they were excellent metal workers. They could produce fine armor, the conical helmets, the various scimitars and battle axes needed for close order fighting. And so at the start of what we would call the Middle Ages, certainly by the 4th and 5th centuries AD, the Turkish nomadic warriors are far better armed and equipped, have far better saddles and stirrups than any of the earlier nomadic peoples, the Shuang Nu, the Tokharian speakers, the Saka, the groups that we have discussed earlier and antiquity. And therefore, they are a far more formidable cavalry force. And invariably, these nomadic armies now have a component of what we would call heavy cavalry, lancers, men who could close and fight in close order. They have the body armor and the weapons, as well as large numbers of horse archers who would open the attack by harassing the enemy, wearing them down, luring them into a premature attack. All of the Khanates that we're talking about, the Avars, the Gurk Turks who follow them, and then the Uyghur Turks, all of them field similar armies, similar type of armored warriors, horse archers, and they employed the same tactics and strategy. And remarkably, these tactics and strategy will dominate the battlefield into the 15th century. And as I've mentioned before, it's only the advent of firearms that really undermines this entire system of fighting. And you have to understand that these Turks are trained from birth to fight as warriors, to hunt. In fact, the famous kind of polo game played by Turks still survives across Central Asia and into Mongolia, buzkashi, which is a rough and ready polo played with the carcass of a goat. And it's a pretty brutal sport, and a sport that also trains you for the kind of expert horse riding that would require men to ride within 10 or 20 yards of the foe, shoot arrows into him, flee before the enemy can even react, then turn on a dime to counterattack should the enemy give you that opportunity. Well, the Avars, as best as we can determine, were Turkish speakers, and from 330 AD or thereabouts down to a rebellion that was carried out by their subject Turks in the Altai Mountains, a man named Bumin, who in 551, 552 overthrew the Avars. They dominated the eastern steppes based on these armies. And they were able to negotiate terms with the dynasties then ruling in China. And we will return to these dynasties in China in the upcoming lecture. And these included particularly Chinese emperors of what are known as the Northern Wei Dynasty. And what they really were related Turks, called in Chinese sources the Toba people. They have a variety of names, who've established themselves in northern China, in the Yellow River Valley, along the Great Wall, although the Great Wall is falling out of use because they really don't have the resources to maintain it. And they are nomadic warriors trying to rule northern China in the guise of Chinese emperors. They also clash with the Hephthalites, probably Tocharian-speaking people who succeeded to the empire of the Kushans, who attempted to dominate the Tarim Basin and the cities of Transoxiana. That is, those wealthy caravan cities that really net so many advantages to the nomadic peoples. So the Avar Khans repeatedly negotiated with the emperors of the Northern Wei. They exchanged embassies as well as lots of border wars with the Hephthalites. And as a result, they get in on part of that trade, again, to acquire the silks and the other goods that allow the Khan to rule a confederation of inner and outer tribes. Well, I mentioned that very abruptly, somewhere in 551, 552, a vassal ruler of this confederacy, a man named Bumin, who ruled a group of people who come to call themselves the Gurk Turks. And the Gurk Turks means the Sky Turks, the Celestial Turks. Gurk is still a Turkish word for sky. It means the blue sky. It's associated with the blue color. And it's probably a Turkish version of the notion of the Son of Heaven in Chinese ideology. They overthrow the Avars very rapidly. It's essentially an internal rebellion. And Bumin had a private quarrel with the last Avar Khan. He had been denied a royal marriage. There had been some kind of dishonoring of him. And his followers were particularly well-armed because they had been the people producing the weapons that armed the confederacy of the Avar Khanate. And as a result, Bumin, who dies soon after the rebellion, establishes the second great Khanate on the steppes. He seizes the traditional regions, the Orkhon Valley. He is acclaimed Khan by probably an assembly that already resembles the Kurultai, that is the assemblies of rulers, of Khans and princes, who give their approval to the man who will lead the confederation. And this is a feature of not only various Turkish confederations, but also the Mongols. You have to be approved by this assembly. Don't mistake it for democracy. It's an assembly of the greater ones. Now, the significant point about the Gurk Turks is they do not confine their activities to just the eastern steppes, the Tarim Basin. They are responsible for a very rapid expansion of the Turks across the central and western steppes. In the course of the 6th century, Turkish speakers now extend all the way into those Pontic Caspian steppes, penetrating to the shores of the Black Sea, to the steppes around the Caspian and Aral Seas. And they come into contact with the Sassanid Empire and the Byzantine Empire, as well as with the various kingdoms in China. They're not yet quite reunified until 581 under the Sui Dynasty, but this Turkish confederacy borders on all three of these great literate urban civilizations. And that expansion sees several important changes. It begins a linguistic transformation of the steppes. The Turks prove extremely adaptable in learning as well as assimilating other steppe peoples who up until this time mostly spoke Iranian languages. And between the 6th century AD, when literally Bumin gives his brother, Ishtemi, his younger brother, the commission, look, you go west, you pursue the Avars who eventually run. They end up in Western Europe. They actually end up ultimately in Hungary, trying to flee the Gurk Turks and enter into alliance with Constantinople in part to escape their overlords, their would-be overlords, the Gurk Turks. He tells his brother, Istemi, you run these guys down and bring the various other steppes under control, which he very successfully does. And after Bumin dies, either in 552 or 553, shortly after he overthrew the Avars, this khanate essentially divides into two. There is the Eastern Gurk khanate, centered on the traditional homelands, and there is a Western Gurk khanate, which centers on the central lands and has aspirations to bring the Western steppes under control. This is not just a matter of lateral succession, but also a matter of size, that the military abilities of the Gurk Turks are so great, they're able to incorporate so much of the steppes under a single confederacy, that that forces a political division because of questions of time and communication. You have to remember that Bumen is ruling in the Turkish heartland in what is today central Mongolia, close to the later capital of Genghis Khan, and that is 3,000 miles away from where his brother is operating on the shores of the Caspian or fighting the Sassanid Shah in Transoxiana. And you just cannot rule this state from a single center. And so this partition of great khanates becomes a feature ever after, and it is a major feature of the Mongolian Empire, the Mongol Empire conquered by Genghis Khan and especially his grandsons. The second important point I mentioned, of course, is that you have a major linguistic and ethnic transformation going on. That is, Turkish language has now become the language of the steppes, and with that comes a sort of cultural koine that unites the various steppe peoples henceforth. And also, this is a matter of power. The khanates, the Gurk Turk khans, have military power on an order that no one has seen on the steppes, really, at least the central and eastern steppes, since the time of Modu Chanyu and the Shuang Nu. Well, this eastern khanate runs into trouble. It draws the attention of the Chinese emperors, particularly the Tang emperors. And the Tang emperors in 618 unify China into a great military state. And they immediately target the northern lands as a region to bring under control. And we'll be discussing the Tang emperors. They find the reintroduction of that tribute system that is providing Chinese brides, bolts of silk, in exchange for some kind of submission, as well as access to the horses of the steppes. That is unacceptable. And the first Tang emperors rule virtually as generals and conquerors themselves. And I will argue to some extent they are products of the martial society of northern China. And as a result, the Tang emperors wage major wars against these Gurk Turks. The fighting climaxes in a campaign in 629-630 when the Chinese general, and he's well known from his military manuals, a man by the name of Li Jing, is commissioned to wage a major campaign against the Eastern Turks, and it is a perfect strategic operation and envelopment. He nails the army of the Khans, destroys them with the kind of tactics we've discussed before, and as a result, the Eastern Khanate collapses. Thousands of Turks are captured. They're sent back to China to serve into the Chinese army or settled as colonists. In 657, Tang armies also inflict a serious defeat on the Western Turks in Central Asia. And by 657, really down into the 680s, the central and eastern steppes are literally being ruled by the Chinese emperor. The Tang emperor, the second Tang emperor, Tai Tsung, could style himself not only as the emperor of China, but also effectively as the Khan of the nomadic peoples, the people of the felt tents. And this was a major achievement. No other urban civilization, organized army of the entire Middle Ages or even of antiquity ever won such victories as the Tang emperor did. However, this could not last. And the Tang Empire went into a decline, particularly brought on by the An Lushan Rebellion, which breaks out from 755 to 763. We'll discuss that in the upcoming lecture. But what happens is that the weakening of the Tang dynasty allows the Turks to reestablish their independence. They shake off the control of the Tang in a rebellion in 680, 681, And we have a remarkable set of inscriptions that were set up by these later restored Turkish Khans in the Orkhon Valley. And these are the earliest examples of Turkish. They're written in a runic script, a script that looks a lot like Germanic runes, but is unrelated to it. And in it, the man who is what is known as Yabgu, that is a subordinate Khan, his name is Toyukuk. He put the Khan on the throne, the Khan Bilge. And he has a long inscription, which is quite significant because it's the first time we have direct evidence from these nomadic peoples. And he, Toyukuk, warns his Khan and his people not to become too assimilated by Chinese ways, not to build Taoist temples, not to build Buddhist stupas, to be careful in the material culture, and above all, not to lose the military virtues. This is an issue that will be raised again in the Mongol Empire, as well as Turkish tribes who enter into the Islamic world. The inscription, which is today, and the whole site, which is regarded as a World Heritage site, is known to all Turkish speakers today. Any Turk would know, yes, that is the first Turkish that we have, and the modern Turkish languages are still fairly closely related to that early form of Turkish from the 720s. Those inscriptions really marked the height of the Turk Khanate. Within 20 years of those inscriptions, the Khanate collapsed. It was overthrown again by subjects, that is a subject tribe of the Confederation, who were also Turks, between 742 and 744. A new group of Turks known as Uyghurs, they are known to people who have been following the news in the relationship between the Uyghurs and the Chinese in Chinese Turkestan or Xinjiang. Today, we used to call it Xinjiang, but they're not there yet. They're actually on the Mongolian steppes. The Uyghurs construct the third Khanate. In some ways, they represent a new improved Khanate over the previous two. Their power doesn't extend as far west. Essentially, the western zones, even much of the central steppes, was loosely affiliated with this Khanate. But the Uyghurs are important for several reasons. One, they very quickly come to embrace Manichaeism. There is an official conversion to that faith brought by Sogdian merchants. The Uyghurs develop their own script, ultimately based on the Brahmi script. They quickly also establish settlements. They turn their tent encampments into what look like incipient towns. And the Uyghurs establish a very, very close relationship with the caravan cities and with the later Tang emperors. And that results in important cultural influences emanating from China and from the caravan cities of the Silk Road entering into the eastern and central steppes. And that is one of the most important roles they play. And as a result, the Uyghurs, among all of the Turks, were regarded as the most accomplished and civilized. This is, for instance, documented in their political dealings with the Chinese Empire. We know of 13 different Uyghur Khans. Seven of them, essentially half, married Chinese princesses. And these would have been women who arrived from the Tang court. Some of them were of the imperial family, other from high members of the court. They would have arrived with great retinues, would have been received by the Uyghurs. That was they're essentially equivalent to grand caravans. And with it came artisans and entertainers, scribes. And the Uyghurs were extremely receptive to all of these cultural influences and really enriched the society of the Eastern Steppes. They were tolerant of all the religions, even though they favored Manichaeism. And when we turn to the Mongol Empire, the Uyghurs were regarded as the natural administrative staff for the Mongols. Genghis Khan immediately starts, as soon as he's on his world conquest, he's using Uyghurs to run his empire. They also allow the dissemination of Nestorian Christianity and Buddhism across the eastern steppes. So on the eve of the unification of the Mongol tribes by Genghis Khan, many of the tribes are already Buddhists. Some are Nestorian Christians. There are still some Manichaeists. Many of them have departed from their traditional animist religion. Well, the Uyghur Khanate also lasts for about a century before it too is overthrown. And again, it is overthrown by subject tribes. The capital is destroyed in 845. It's abandoned. And the successors, these Kyrgyz Turks, who are the ancestors of today, the Turks of Kyrgyzstan, they essentially overthrow Uyghur power and then leave. And many of the Uyghurs migrate into the cities of the Tarim Basin and eventually merge with the sedentary populations and bring their language and their traditions there. Well, I want to stop with a couple of conclusions about these three Turkish Khanates. They were the dress rehearsals for the Mongolian Empire, the great Mongol Empire of Genghis Khan. And second, they forged more impressive political organizations and brought the Turks into contact with the settled civilizations very intimately. And above all, with the civilization of Islam, which is soon to emerge. And it is the great interaction between the Turks and Islam that will change the life of the steppes and also change the emerging Islamic world.
Lecture 15, Turkmen Khans and Tang Emperors.
In this lecture, I wish to deal with the interaction between the Turks and the Chinese Empire. I mentioned it in passing in the previous lecture, that Turks and Chinese have long been in contact with each other, and that Chinese civilization is one of the great forces that exerts cultural influence and change on the Eurasian steppes. And in this lecture, I want to examine that question much more thoroughly. In the last lecture, we talked about the three great early Turkish Khanates. The first of them were the Avar Khans, who ruled from about 330 to 552. They were overthrown by an internal rebellion. The second two Khanates, however, the Gurk Turks, or as we sometimes call them, the Celestial Turks, would be an English translation, and then their successors, the Uyghurs, both of those states were brought down not only by internal rebellion, but by rebels who had been egged on and generally financed by the Chinese emperors. And that brings us back to China and the role that China plays vis-a-vis the nomadic peoples of the eastern steppes, and also the struggle between the Chinese and nomadic confederations to control the crucial eastern arm of the Silk Road. That is the routes running from northern China through the Jade Gate, the Yumen Pass, into the cities of the Tarim Basin, over the city of Kashgar, which is today in Tajikistan, and then to the cities of Central Asia. That is Samarkand, Bukhara, cities well known as the fabled caravan cities of the Silk Road. Now, this requires us to do a couple of things in this lecture. First, we want to update what has been happening in China ever since the Han Dynasty fragmented in 220 AD. Then we want to look at the question of the interaction between the nomads who settle in China, not the confederacies I just talked about, the Avars, the Gurk Turks, and the Uyghurs, but Turkic-speaking peoples who actually settle in northern China and pass themselves off as Chinese emperors. And then we want to look at the unification of China under the Sui and the Tang emperors and their relationship with both the Gurk Turks and also the Uyghurs. Well, first, some update on what has happened to China since 220 AD. I mentioned in a previous lecture that the Empire of the Han, the great dynasty established in 206 BC and running to 220 AD, was roughly contemporary with the Roman Empire, and that the Han Empire had evolved the initial policies. In fact, it could be attributed to the Emperor Wu Di, who initiated a war against the Xuanzu in 133 BC, and in many ways sets a lot of the priorities on the Chinese political agenda, diplomatic front, really down to this day. And one can argue that successive Chinese emperors really were influenced by that notion that the Middle Kingdom, China, had the right to rule these various areas along the northern frontier and deep into Central Asia to control the vital Silk Route. Now, in 220 AD, the Han Empire fragmented. It fragmented into three competing kingdoms. And this fragmentation into three kingdoms reproduced earlier patterns, patterns before the year 221 BC, when the first empire was established, the so-called period of the Warring States, usually dated from 481 to 221 BC. There were three kingdoms contending in the south. Briefly, they were united by emperors known as the Jin emperors. They maintained a brief unity, and then it collapsed again into well over 12 or 15 competing principalities. In this political landscape of civil war, rebellions, migrations, there are a couple of important facts to keep in mind. First, the locus of Chinese civilization shifts. It shifts from the Yellow River down into the Yangtze or Yangtze River basin, that is, to the south. It is in the south where many Chinese will migrate from their traditional homeland into regions that offered better opportunity, particularly for the cultivation of rice, the cultivation of silk, what we would call sericulture, as well as stock raising. The southern regions of China offered a great deal more opportunity to exploit the landscape, support great cities, and also to become the repositories of Chinese civilization. And already in the period of the 3rd and 4th and 5th centuries AD, there was a migration of Chinese south. Some of this was encouraged by the southern kingdoms, such as the Kingdom of Wu, the Kingdom of Qi, which were located in the south. These were local dynasties that ruled only part of southern China. Nonetheless, they encouraged immigrants. And above all, they maintained themselves. These courts maintained themselves as the true Confucian rulers, the Confucian rulers who followed the proper way. And in many ways, they will anticipate the great Song dynasty, which will come to power in 960 and will rest in southern China and will really uphold the position that they are heirs to the Han Empire, even though they don't control the Han heartland. That is the traditional capitals of Luoyang and Chang'an, which are on the Yellow River, in the lower and middle reaches of the Yellow River, and had been the capitals of so many earlier Chinese civilizations. Another important feature in this period is that nomadic peoples begin to migrate inside of China. This does not mean the borderlands just north of the Great Wall. This period witnesses actual movements of people who are Turkish speakers primarily. In Chinese, they're known as the Toba, the Tobakh, one name. They are apparently Turkish speakers, and in the 4th century, they move into the northern regions of China. They are contemporary with the Avar Khans, but they're not subjects of the Avar Khans, quite the contrary. They carve out their own frontier kingdom in the Yellow River Basin and in those frontier zones, the Ordos Triangle, the regions of Inner Mongolia, and they begin to rule increasingly as if they were Chinese emperors. And the rulers take Chinese names. They style themselves as if they are more or less conforming to the Confucian norms. And one of these, the first ruler we know, the founder of this dynasty, Dao Wu, he in a sense, ruled not only as a nomadic Khan, as you will, who had access to cavalry, nomadic cavalry, but also as a Chinese-style emperor. He and his successors sponsored Buddhism. They put access to the Silk Road as a top priority. They garrisoned the Jade Gate. They